Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1793, President George Washington stormed into a cabinet meeting clutching a newspaper, enraged at the unfairness of his portrayal. This started a new American tradition of presidents stomping on newspapers. This is an episode told in the new book, The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battles Between the White House and the Media. The author joins us, presidential historian Harold Holzer. He's a historian of the presidents, and especially with Lincoln, and now he turns his view towards the media. And Harold Holzer, welcome to The Source. So tell us about this episode with George Washington, you in your book, and why he was so upset with the newspaper.
Well, he had been used to not being criticized. He had the longest press honeymoon of any president after him. Obviously, he was the first, but he had been revered as a secular saint of America. And just to set this in context, his own Secretary of State did not give a convention speech in his behalf. He actually imported an anti-federalist editor from New York to the federal capital in Philadelphia and urged him to set up an opposition newspaper in the Capitol to criticize his own administration, essentially. He offered the editor a job in the State Department so he would have the financial resources to conduct the anti-Washington campaign. It's extraordinary, even by modern standards, but that was truly the beginning of the combat between presidents and the press, and in this case, engineered from within the administration. So Washington sees a disobliging caricature in a newspaper. I think it showed him being guillotined. And he threw it on the ground in front of his cabinet members. Jefferson himself must have been particularly amused that he had gotten that kind of a reaction. And he just shredded it with his boots. It was not the last time that Washington would erupt about the next 4 years, 5 years of newspaper coverage that he endured.
So back in that era, newspapers were hyper-partisan, and they were constructed with a particular point of view. And so it was entirely about one paper, the construction, the attitudes, the professionalism of reporters, nothing like we have today.
Well, some would argue otherwise. I agree with you, or I agree with the predicate in the question, but keep in mind that it was not just a philosophical affiliation, it was a financial affiliation as well. It was a cultural affiliation. The newspapers who supported the administration got government printing contracts. The administration in power would employ editors in federal jobs. That certainly hardened the loyalty, cemented the loyalty of newspapers, which were otherwise philosophically aligned. And there is, you know, one notorious example from this period in history of a newspaper, of an influential editor who changed sides, you know, instantly because he didn't get the political reward he thought he was entitled to.
So those are hacks. We call them hacks.
I think they didn't have that word then, but yeah, we could. Sure.
All right,
but
so again, what I want to do is, as we examine the history. Go ahead.
It was just standard operating procedure, culturally acceptable and recognized through the end of the 18th and all of the 19th century.
Sure. And today we have professional associations, we have ethics, we have ways to hold reporters accountable, although there are failures in that. But certainly we have higher standards today for legitimate news outlets. So what I really want to do as we start off, we have this important conversation as we talk about the history of presidents and their beneficial adversarial relationship with the news. I want to be very careful about trying to draw a direct line, because if George Washington was mad about his coverage of the newspaper, well, then what another president might do, say like Donald Trump, well, then that's okay.
I absolutely get where you're coming from. The difference is that some presidents complained. Almost all of them felt justified because they all believed they should be praised and admired all of the time, every day. But a few stand out in history as being particularly corrosive and punitive. And interestingly, Donald Trump may not even make the top quartet of presidents who actually struck genuine fear into the hearts of journalists and, in fact, persecuted and prosecuted them.
And we'll get into that. It's important that when a new administration begins and they have they may count on having a honeymoon or a love affair with a quick time when they get along with the news media, but not always. So here's an example from Sean Spicer and the very first the first full day of the Trump administration.
Photographs of the inaugural proceedings were intentionally framed in a way, in one particular tweet, to minimize the enormous support that had gathered on the National Mall. This was the first time in our nation's history that floor coverings had been used to protect the grass in the mall. That had the effect of highlighting any areas where people were not standing, while in years past, the grass eliminated this visual. This was also the first time that fencing and magnetometers went as far back on the wall, preventing hundreds of thousands of people from being able to access the mall as quickly as they had in inaugurations past. Inaccurate numbers involving crowd size were also tweeted. No one had numbers because the National Park Service, which controls the National Mall, does not put any out. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe. Even the New York Times printed a photograph showing that a misrepresentation of the crowd in the original tweet in their paper, which showed the full extent of the support, depth, and crowd and intensity that existed. These attempts to lessen the enthusiasm of the inauguration are shameful and wrong.
So, Harold Holzer, in your coverage of the history of presidents and the press, was it unusual that the very first day we had this Sean Spicer up there berating the press for the numbers, the account of the numbers watching the inauguration?
I would say it's pretty unique. And bear in mind that as that tirade was occurring, President Trump himself on January 21st was spending his first full day in office visiting the CIA, ostensibly to assure them that his criticism of that the intelligence community during the campaign was not serious, and he embraced his leadership of the intelligence community at that moment. Instead, he immediately said that he had never criticized the intelligence community and that the fake news had invented the story. So it was really a double-barreled attack, one from Langley and one from the White House, and both, you know, demonstrably false. And if there ever was going to be a press honeymoon between the media and Donald Trump, it definitely ended that day. And Sean Spicer himself has written about, you know, his humiliation at being hung out to dry. I think he had to do that twice. And it may be that what you just played was the second attempt to do it, because the first time he sort of implied that it was the largest crowd if you include television, and the second time he was much more specific. He finally got a good job from Trump, who then replaced him anyway. So there you go.
All right, we're speaking with Harold Holzer. We're talking about his book, The Presidents Versus the Press, and the history, the long history, comprehensive history of presidents with their adversarial relationship with the news media. If you have a question or a comment, you can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Well, Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the history of the presidents versus the press. That's the title of a book by Harold Holzer. He's a presidential historian. So, Harold Holzer, is this a good thing? Can we at least say that when we have the press asking questions and holding a president accountable or pointing out certain things that he says or does, is that good, and we should recognize it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they don't call it the Fourth Estate for nothing. It's a pillar whose scrutiny is every bit as important as judicial review or legislative oversight. It's the eternal spotlight and on executive authority and performance. And Thomas Jefferson, and I say even for a reason, because I think he was somewhat hypocritical about the press, railing against them and encouraging their prosecution at the state level if they differed with him. But in his aspiration, in a similar vein as he aspired to all men being equal but didn't exactly practice it, he believed that if the choice was between a free government and a free press, the free press was probably more important. And he said, you know, where the press is free and every man able to read, all is safe. So I do think that it is obviously, as it has evolved, the crucial blowback, especially when all branches of the government are in the control of one institution or one party.
But Thomas Jefferson also famously said he doesn't read any of the newspapers other than the local newspaper, and the only thing he trusts are the advertisements.
Yeah, well, I think, I suspect that was meant as a joke, because I learned that when he donated his famous collection of books, his library, to the Library of Congress, actually creating the guts of the Library of Congress, that he included his newspapers. And it turned out that almost every newspaper he'd ever read, he had saved. Whether it was for his papers or his memoirs, we don't know. But he was a pretty astute and careful newspaper reader and also arranger of newspapers. He created a government newspaper when he became president. He invited an editor to set up in Washington, the new capital, even as he kept his former pro-party newspaper operating in the country's largest city, Philadelphia. So he was pretty shrewd about it. And he wasn't just, spouting ideals about the free press. He was a tough practitioner of partisan journalism himself.
We're talking about the presidents, all of them, versus the press. You can call in with your questions or comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So you said there are other presidents that you say would make Donald Trump just, you know, shrink in comparison to how they took on the press. Who are these other presidents?
And I just want to explain. I mean, I do think Trump's bark is worse than his bite, and I'm not including, you know, the corrosive effect of the constant criticism and what that does to national confidence in a free press. But whether it's because he really has no interest in other than kind of a performance art where it comes to battling the press, or whether he just doesn't know how to organize his antipathy into anything meaningful, I don't think organizing government activity is his strong suit. That's personal opinion. But yes, the record shows that there have been much worse experiences for journalists in covering presidents. And I'll start with John Adams, Washington's successor. He signed and enforced a federal law making it a crime to ridicule the President of the United States. And in pursuing this sedition law, a number of pro-Jefferson editors were put on trial, fined, and imprisoned. That's about the most outrageous overreach in history. America was not at war, which at least Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt, who were pretty controlling, could argue. Adams just did it because he was worried about a war, about embroiling America in another war with Great Britain or France in his case. So that's the most outrageous oversight. I once had a discussion about this with President George W. Bush. And he said, and we were actually discussing David McCullough's book on John Adams, and he said he thought that McCullough, I probably shouldn't, well, I wrote about it so I can reveal it. He said McCullough, he thinks, gave Adams something of a free pass on the Alien and Sedition Acts. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I have often thought about imprisoning the owner of the New York Times, and he winked, and he said, but I never have. So there is no excuse for cracking down against free press unless there is a real threat, an existential threat to the Constitution itself.
There are other people who probably would have liked to imprison the editor of the New York Times, but for different reasons other than what President George W. Bush wanted to do. So I'm thinking about what happened with the leaks that came from the administration, things that helped drive America into the Iraq War, and certainly questions about the role that Judith Miller, a reporter for the Times at the time, that she took on.
Yeah, and I write about, and full disclosure, I know Judy Miller, and yeah, it was a tough time, and there is a thread of that began probably with the Nixon administration, and speaking of the New York Times, the efforts to suppress both the Times and the Washington Post, but originally, whatever the movie claims, the New York Times, to prevent the publication of the Pentagon Papers, and Punch Sulzberger, whom I came to know later, courageously insisted on the press's right to the material and fought the Nixon administration all the way to the Supreme Court, and as we know, memorably, decisively won.
Yeah, but the Judith Miller episode may illustrate what happens when you have a press on bended knee and you are willing to run with whatever they tell you and not hold them to a level of scrutiny that could prevent entry into an unnecessary war.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the curious thing with Judith Miller is that there was also a contention that she was protecting sources, when in fact it probably was more like she was accepting sources without filtering them properly.
She did spend 85 days in jail, contempt of court, refusing to admit that it was Scooter Libby that gave her the information that outed Valerie Plame as a CIA agent.
Yeah, and destroy their marriage and, expose them to genuine threat. Yeah, it was a rough time. And secrecy will do that. Especially administrations since, say, Nixon have been embroiled in leaking and plugging leaks at the same time. It's pervasive. And there are accounts in the book of, Ronald Reagan, who is said to not be terribly organized or focused on details, conducting really intense searches for the sources within his administration that were getting stories out to the press. This is part of the tension, I suppose. And yes, it's incumbent on the press to check sources and not take government information at face value.
If he was looking for a leaker, he should have looked at Henry Kissinger. Let's go to a caller, James. And James, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Do you have a question for presidential historian Harold Holzer?
Hi, yes. Thanks for having me on the show. I was just curious, because it seems like there's a lot of presidents who can't handle any criticism. Are there any who have gracefully handled criticism? And are there presidents who have been able to admit when they have made mistakes and been wrong? It also seems like most presidents of the past can't accept or acknowledge mistakes they've made as though it were some sort of weakness.
James, thank you for that great call. Yeah, Harold Holzer.
Great question. I think presidents are usually thin-skinned about criticism. One president who was probably best at letting personal criticism roll off his back and accepting responsibility, I have to admit, did not earn a chapter of his own in my book. He was sort of attached to a chapter because I couldn't cover all 44 men who have served as president. But I'm talking about Harry Truman. He was deservedly famous for saying the buck stops here and for saying when I make a mistake, it's a mistake. That was pretty unusual. But I do love, and I included this story, the story of Truman kind of outrageously coming to the defense of his daughter, who performed a vocal concert in Washington and was pretty decimated by the music critic who wrote a review of the concert. Truman wrote a letter to the critic, and clearly his own, without help from any aides, and he wrote, "If I ever meet you, you will need a raw steak for your eye and a supporter for below." And actually, the critic never published it, but another newspaper got hold of it. And it accrued to Truman's benefit. People thought, well, here's a guy defending his daughter, and it's sort of noble, and I think he got an extra boost from it. What people don't know is that one of the explanations for the tirade is that his press secretary, who protected him pretty well, literally dropped dead at his desk in the White House on the very night of the concert. And I think Truman was so filled with anxiety and so upset and so without benefit of counsel, as it happened, that he went flying off on his own. But it's a pretty good episode of what a unique character he was.
So there's another story about Truman when he was playing the piano at a public event, and Lauren Bacall jumped on top of the piano and they took his photograph, and looked very salacious. And he took heck at home for that photograph from the family, but it was a great publicity. So he may not have known it, but just getting your name out there and engaging people in a way that's very friendly is a way to help drive up your numbers.
By the way, can I tell you one story about that photograph? I was at a political fundraiser at Eunice Shriver's house one day, and Lauren Bacall was there, and it was for an older congressman from Virginia. And he went over to Lauren Bacall and said, "I have to tell you that when I was a young man, the photograph of you sitting on top of the upright piano with President Truman made my pulse race." And she looked at him and said, "Oh, that effing piano photo again." So it has a different impact on different people.
But it was good publicity for President Truman.
It was good publicity for both of them, yes, but absolutely for President Truman.
All right, so our phone lines are open. If you have a question for presidential historian Harold Holzer about the relationship between the news media and the presidents, all of them, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back.
Poor and low-income workers fight for a living wage, guaranteed health care, housing, and education programs. These are, in fact, issues that affect all of society.
This indeed actually doesn't just impact poor and low-wage workers, but it redounds to the benefit of all.
How poor and low-income voters can change the political landscape. Next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We frequently see President Trump having engagements with reporters, sometimes calling them fake news, calling them nasty, all sorts of names, trying to delegitimize them in the eyes of the public. And this is something that he does. It's a political tool. It is a show that he does in order to try to reduce the negative information that's out there about him to his base. But is this something new? Have other presidents done similar tactics? Is this just the tradition or just the manner of being a president, or is this something different? We're joined by Harold Holzer. He is the author of the book, The Presidents Versus the Press. And if you have a question or a comment about the relationship between the news media and the presidents and what works, what doesn't work, and what can be done to try and make this work better for the benefit of the American people, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Jim is on the line. Jim, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, when and would he consider the press either most powerful or in best balance or with the three branches of government?
Jim, thank you for that question. Harold Holzer,
yeah,
over
another excellent question. I mean, there are two kinds of power that the press has exerted in American history. One is the power of influencing public opinion, and one might say that in the New Deal era, the editorial power and the power of influence just before radio became pervasive of the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times was at its peak. There was a day even in the Kennedy era when the two Dallas papers came to a publisher's lunch at the White House, and Kennedy took a lot of heat from one of the newspapers that was more conservatively oriented than another. And then the next paper, the other paper, the liberal paper, wrote to Kennedy and said, I apologize for what my fellow Texan said. And Kennedy said, well, now I know why the people in Dallas really don't come to their senses until the afternoon. Sort of an ominous story, but it illustrates that presidents have understood the power of the press from the beginning. But in the 19th century, power by journalists was accrued by their connection to politics. In the 19th century, journalism was like a cog in the political machine for both parties. Journalists spread party doctrine. They printed slanted news, partisan news, according to their political affiliation, and then they anticipated and often were satisfied with rewards for their service. Newspapermen became part of the government. They were appointed to federal jobs. They had positions of influence, which only enhanced their journalistic power. They received government printing contracts. They were government advertising. You see these letters in the midst of the Civil War. Lincoln saying, please give this newspaper the advertising that I promised. So that's the kind of power they exerted, and that's the kind of reward they received at the peak of partisan journalism. But I think a lot of journalists have settled for access. I think just to be in the ray, in the glare, and in the presence of leaders, whether it's for purposes of influence or purposes of, you know, collecting material for a memoir, that's been a source of reward and power for journalists as well.
To that, we have a clip here from President Kennedy.
Members of the American Society, newspaper editors, ladies and gentlemen, the president of a great democracy such as ours, and the editors of great newspapers such as yours, owe a common obligation to the people, an obligation to present the facts, to present them with candor, and to present them in perspective.
So Kennedy was seduced many reporters. They wanted to be in his presence, and then he had these televised press conferences, calling on them by name, making them celebrities. He was able to manipulate the press in new ways.
And thank you for playing that clip, which I haven't heard for, you know, 2 years when I first began to go into the video sources at the Kennedy Library. A few paragraphs later, Kennedy said, I wanted to call this speech the President versus the Press, but I decided to call it the President and the Press, almost like an ominous warning. So I decided at that moment to change the title of my book, which I had tentatively called The Presidents and the Press, and I made it The Presidents versus the Press, because I think Kennedy helped me see again the adversarial relationship. That was an interesting moment for Kennedy, because Yes, he was chummy with a lot of journalists. He had been a journalist himself. He had begun going around the traditional press by staging these extraordinarily effective theatrical news conferences. I mean, I watched them when I was a kid. They were must-see TV. I rushed home from school to make sure I caught a 4 o'clock news conference because you always knew there was going to be something newsworthy or something funny because of his wit and that he was going to parry with the reporters in a dignified but still adversarial manner. But he also wanted to clamp down on coverage that he thought exposed American interests to scrutiny that was unhealthy for the survival of the country. This is a refrain that we've heard from presidents all through. And this speech came to the publishers, came right after the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, which was a disaster. As the training was going on, Kennedy learned that a newspaper had the story of the plan and was going to run with it. So the president and the president's father both exerted their influence on the publisher and persuaded him that it would be close to treasonous to publish the article. After the invasion failed miserably and publicly, Kennedy was mad at the paper for not alerting the public and him to the fact that the plan was flawed. So Kennedy was definitely someone who wanted to have it both ways. By sheer personality, he often got what he wanted. He wanted his secrets kept secret by journalists who knew better. He wanted his successes to be trumpeted forth, and he wanted his failures to be minimized. And he warned his staff, this is a naturally adversarial position. Don't be seduced by the press. And he was also capable of doing what Donald Trump did on one occasion. If you remember, Trump went on Fox TV and said, I'm canceling my subscription to the New York Times. They're going to pay for this. No more White House subscriptions to the Times. I don't know if he followed through. But at one point, Kennedy canceled the White House subscription to the New York Herald Tribune and was very widely criticized for doing so, being petulant and childish. And all the while, Jackie Kennedy was having the paper delivered to her anyway because she loved the style section. So eventually he relented and took the Tribune back into his reading folder.
Here's another clip. This is Walter Cronkite.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. But it is increasingly clear to this reporter that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
With American sons in the field far away, with America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
And that voice was Lyndon Johnson. And they people like have reported that those two instances are very much so related.
Yes, very much so. And boy, what a thrill it is to hear all the voices that you've accumulated for this program. Thank you. So Cronkite reporting in a documentary from Vietnam stimulated Johnson. And Johnson watched it with his staff, and he reportedly turned to his aides and said, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. At the same time, it might be added, Life magazine turned against the war, too, another just widely circulated Middle American weekly that was once, you know, crucial reading for Americans. And as you played in the clip, after the New Hampshire primary, which Johnson actually won and didn't lose, but not by enough to satisfy observers, he did drop out of the race. He, I think, would not have lived had he run, because he died afterwards, before his term would have ended had he been reelected. So, yeah, this. But Johnson deserves credit for one thing that he often doesn't get credit for, and I haven't been able to discuss Johnson enough, I think. He's just a fascinating figure as he related to the press. He spent an obsessive amount of time, not unlike Donald Trump, on press relations, in everything from glossy photographs to making the staff of the White House buy transistor radios so they could always be listening to the news constantly. But he deserves credit for something that subsequent presidents sort of slipped away from without much complaint, and that is he allowed for open coverage in the World War II tradition of the Vietnam War. For all of the sorrows and horror of the war, and for all of the so-called credibility gap that he opened in what he was reporting and what was being experienced, Cronkite wouldn't have filed that report had he not been there with cameras to observe things firsthand. It was the first television war, and Johnson did nothing to inhibit coverage. If you look at coverage of modern wars, there are no bodies shown. Very few, even arrivals of flag-draped coffins in the United States. What we see are precision bombing on television. It's almost like a video game, and it just affirms American technological superiority without dwelling and spending much time on the consequences. I think that's a loss for openness. But Johnson, even though it destroyed him or helped destroy him, was willing to tolerate a free press in that regard.
We're going to take a break here. The number, if you want to call in, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Also, we'll talk about Abraham Lincoln and how he actually shut down newspapers. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davis. We're getting some context, a historic perspective of the relationship between the news media and the presidents, and about how this is a positive for people, our government, us, to be able to have oversight, hold the president accountable. And presidents don't always like it, but this is our system. This is the way it has been since George Washington. And with us to help us understand this is Harold Holzer. His book is The Presidents Versus the Press. So when we're going to break, Harold, we're talking about LBJ. One more quick question about that. So he was frequently was very aggressive. He would grab people by the lapel, and he would get in people's faces, reporters too, and just tell them all sorts of crazy things. Dan Rather has some stories about that, and how he just walked out on LBJ at the ranch, and he's walking down the Caliche Road trying to get back to, and then Lady Bird would drive up and say, "Oh, he didn't mean that. He's come on back in, Dan. Let me get you back inside. We'll smooth this over." That seemed to happen with some regularity.
Speaking of Texans, Tom Wicker tells a story that I relate in the book, that he was summoned as the new White House correspondent to LBJ, but LBJ was getting a haircut at the time, so he had a big drape over his suit, and Wicker came in. He had just written a story that evidently Johnson didn't like, and Wicker knew it, and he stood there, and Johnson just did not speak. The haircut continued, no conversation. Nothing. Wicker became really agitated by the lack of communication. And finally he said, "Mr. President, I'm so glad you're leading the country." And Johnson jumped up and grabbed him in that embrace that most reporters didn't like. And that's how Johnson would also woo you, with the threat of silence. He was a master in some ways, but pretty physical, pretty gigantic, pretty oppressive. You know, most reporters did not want to go on nude swimming binges with LBJ, which were accompanied by drinking in the middle of the day, and yet Look magazine writers were subjected to that treatment. They didn't want to be bawled out, but many of them were. They didn't want to do press conferences racing on the White House grounds or in some of the smaller rooms of the White House, but LBJ was determined not to do what Kennedy did. but an amazing character. And, a media mogul of himself. He and Lady Bird were broadcast station owners in Texas. They knew the media. They knew the power of the media.
Let's go to another clip. This is Dan Rather. We talked about Dan Rather. Here he is again, but this time with Richard Nixon.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. President, are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you? Mr. President.
Right, so Harold Holzer, tell us why that was so controversial.
Well, first of all, Richard Nixon decided he wanted to take his press conferences on the road because he felt so constrained. And in the White House, he felt he was being squeezed in and maybe even out of office. So this was a big, like a basketball arena. And Dan Rather was being applauded there when he asked a question, which is not appropriate, really. But it was a crowd that was riled up, and it was, you know, half pro-Nixon, half anti-Nixon. And, presidents are entitled to their little jokes, even at reporters' expense. And that's mild compared to what we've heard from other presidents. Dan Rather could not resist the comeback line. And I've spoken to him about it, and he's written about it. And he says, regret that moment. He thought, in the end, during the 15 seconds of applause, he was conjuring up the line in his head. But he feels in the end that it was probably inappropriate. But it's legendary.
And here's another example of an exchange between reporters and a president, but very, very different.
Do you think that you demonized immigrants in this election to try to keep
them? I want them to come into the country, but they have to come in legally. You know, they have to come in, Jim, through a process. I want it to be a process. And I want people to come in, and we need the people.
Your campaign.
You know why we need the people, don't you? Because we have hundreds of companies moving in. We need the people.
Right. But your campaign had an ad showing migrants climbing over walls and
so on.
Well,
that's true.
They
weren't actors.
They're not going to be doing
that. They weren't actors. Well, no, it's true. Do you think they were actors? They weren't actors. They didn't come from Hollywood. Right. These were people. This was an actual, it happened a few days ago. And
they're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks. Pardon me, ma'am. I'm.
So this instance, there is a female intern or an aide taking the microphone away from Jim Acosta. The next day, the White House accuses him of physically accosting her, and they try to take away his hard pass. So this is something worth noting.
Yeah, and they did take away his pass for a bit. And they did accuse him of inappropriately touching the intern who was, they were in a battle for the microphone. Acosta was doing what I wish more reporters would do is at these press conferences, is rather than say, I have four questions and here they are, which is barely, the viewer and the president can barely follow it, but asking legitimate follow-ups or tough follow-ups. I think that since that incident, the tradition of asking a follow-up question based on an answer that may not be satisfactory or complete is vanishing, and I think that's a loss. And obviously this is an instance of, over-testosterone bullying that has not happened before. But it's part of the reality show culture that we're living with now, and even Donald Trump's most supportive journalists say that it's a show that will one day presumably end. Whether it's in January or 4 years from January is yet to be determined, but I don't think this kind of back and forth will continue in the manner it's been so far.
So let's spend a couple of minutes talking about Abraham Lincoln, which is pretty much impossible to do because there's so much to say about him. But he owned a newspaper, a German newspaper, which he purchased in order to help round up those votes. He shut down other newspapers, which he felt were a threat to the Union people. And he, you know, people would say, you know, Honest Abe was anti-newspaper.
Well, he was certainly pro-newspaper his whole life, and those newspapers who were pro-Whig or pro-Republican, the parties that he belonged to. And he cultivated them, and he courted them, and he hung out in their offices. And when he was president, he appointed them to political jobs. And the editor of that German newspaper that he bailed out of financial difficulty and then became the partner, the editor of that paper, after living up to his agreement to be pro-Republican during the 1860 campaign, got a handsome diplomatic job in Europe. So he played the game. And during the Civil War, Democratic newspapers in the North and in the border states who criticized recruitment or the draft were subject to the hard hand of government. The military, the State Department, the Post Office Department, which we talk about so much, pushed back against these newspapers, refused to mail the papers, threw the papers off trains, and ultimately editors were arrested. They were put in military prisons without trial. Francis Scott Key's grandson was put in Fort McHenry in Baltimore for writing injudiciously about Union troops at the Battle of Bull Run. So he winds up at the same fort that had where the Star-Spangled Banner had once flown, inspiring his grandfather to write the national anthem. How is that for historical irony? And Lincoln defended it. He said why should he shoot a simple-minded soldier boy who deserts and spare the wily agitator who induces him to desert? Why would you sacrifice an entire body, meaning the body politic, to save a limb, meaning freedom of the press, when most people would sacrifice a limb to save the life? That was quite a metaphor in a time of mass amputation of soldiers who were wounded in battle.
So in your book title, you talk about from the Founding Fathers to fake news. And we have legitimate, real, reported stories that are totally backed up with testimony and that are labeled fake news. And so I really don't know about using that term. Well, I mean, defend that term.
Well, I mean, I wanted to say in a quick subtitle that we are running the gamut of the relationships between presidents and the press. And of course, I don't mean to say that there is fake news. I mean to say that this is an easy, perhaps a glib definition of the times that we're living in. And I couldn't resist maybe in unconscious and inexcusable imitation of the alliteration that Spiro Agnew was fond of when he was denouncing the press, put in the founders and the fakes in one subtitle.
Sure. And in your, as you look at things through a perspective of time, you little long view, how when we have the press is undermined, where does that take us in America?
I mean, there is a loss of confidence, according to surveys, in so many institutions, and of course the press is among them. And I can't predict, I fear, what the cumulative effect of the drip, drip, drip of denunciation means. But I think for the moment what it's doing is hardening our fealty toward the partisan media source of our respective choices. Mm-hmm. Or our common choices. And I think this is very much what the situation was in the 19th century when Republicans read the New York Times, for example, and Democrats
right.
read the New York World. I think it's the same now with CNN and MSNBC. I think the one
right.
benefit of...
I've really got to wrap this up, so I really want to thank you, Harold Holzer.
Oh, sure.
The author of The Presidents Versus the Press and many other books. The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, from the Founding Fathers to Fake News. It was great having you. Now, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.